Gospel reductionism replaces the Bible as the source and norm of theology with the gospel. What would a gospel reductionist edition of Luther's Small Catechism look like? Find out in the latest issues, etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Russell Dawn details his journey from Anglicanism to Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
Yes, may I help you?
I used to live here.
Won't you come in? It's the least I can do.
Is it like you remember?
Cleaner.
Well, you feel free to look around while I get the water boiling.
Your hair is winter fire. January embers. My heart burns there, too.
There you go.
Thank you.
Now some music. I do apologize. It gets so very hot here this time of year.
It's fine.
Well, you feel like you could just about die. But you know what they say about Derry. No one who dies here ever really dies.
That's a bit of the trailer of the horror movie It Chapter 2. It's from one book, but it's been made into two different movies. They tell the same story from two different time periods, and it involves a very, very scary clown with a red balloon. Of course, comes from the mind of Stephen King. What should Christians note in this film that has so many themes and ends with the adult escapades in destroying an evil force from outside this universe? The part of several adults who call themselves losers. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Pastor Ted Geese joins us on this Thursday afternoon. We're reviewing the movie It Chapter 2. He has a bachelor's degree in fine arts. He's pastor of Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. And he taught a course for Concordia Lutheran Seminary titled Christianity in the Movies, A Lutheran Approach to Media Consumption. Ted, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd.
Why is this chapter two? In other words, why was one book made into two movies rather than one movie?
The same reason they made three Lord of the Rings movies, I guess. It, by Stephen King, the book is over 1,000 pages long. So that's a lot to get into one movie. You know, oftentimes I think kind of one rule of thumb would be 100 pages equals an hour. So if you have a 300-page book, you're going to have to drop some things to make it work. And of course, you know, books do things that films can't, and films do things that books can't, and vice versa, as it were. So it just is too long a book to get into one movie.
And if I recall correctly, Stephen King's novel was told from an adult perspective, flashing back to the childhood experiences that made up the content of the first It movie, wasn't it?
Yeah. It just kept going back and forth. So it was all kind of interwoven, but you're introduced to some of the adult characters first, and then then the flashbacks start happening and you get to know the kids. And that's the way they did that. So the difference between that first film, It Chapter 1, well, it's not called It Chapter 1, it's just called It from 2017, which we'd reviewed before. And this one is, they kind of, like, Muschietti, the director, made the decision to kind of, like, separate this out a bit. So that first movie from 2017 was really exclusively focused on the kids, like the kid version of these characters. So they're, you know, teens, just on the cusp of teens. They're kind of adolescent kids in that kind of young teenage area. And then what they did in this film was, Andy Muschietti did, is that he kind of went back to that style that is found in King's book, where you flip-flop back and forth, predominantly focusing on the adult versions of these characters, but then weaving in stuff from the kids. And of course, they had to shoot some of that stuff later, so they actually had to use the de-aging software on these kids to make them look like they looked in 2017, right? Because some of them had grown a bit, notably the one from Stranger Things. And Finn Wolfhard had been, he'd grown quite a bit, and they had to do the de-aging on him for this movie. So that's kind of what happened, is that's the way they did this, is they kind of separated them out in that way.
So those who are not familiar with this is probably, besides The Shining, the iconic Stephen King story. It has been called Stand By Me, with a demonic murderous clown thrown in there.
Stand By Me, written also by Stephen King.
Absolutely.
Called The Body. So different, like, yeah. So this is playing on a bunch of that stuff, only going bigger with kind of like this otherworldly element to it.
And of course, we will talk in time about kind of the universe that is revealed in the novel that may not make it into the movie. There's some pretty bizarre stuff about Stephen King's view of the universe, or his novellic universe too. But what's the storyline we're dropping into here in It Chapter 2?
Okay, so the first film, very quickly, was these kids are living in this town of Derry, Maine. It's a fictional town. And all of these abductions are happening. Kids are going missing. But the thing about the town is that the people are just kind of in a morass, or they just don't care. And they don't care when they see kids getting bullied. They don't stop and try to do anything about it. They don't, you know, like, they just kind of look the other way. So this is kind of like it's a bad town. It's gone rotten. And these kids start to piece together that the things that they're afraid of and these experiences of terror that they're having are not just their own. They're shared things, that there actually is this thing that's doing this to all of them. And they start to refer to it as it. And then along the way, it becomes clear that there's this guise that it has of this Pennywise the Dancing Clown that's kind of a terrifying thing to all of them. Then they do their best to try to stop this, and by the end of the movie, they quote-unquote have, except for the fact that it seems like there's a pattern in this town. Every 27 years, things go haywire. So they wisely say to themselves, if 27 years from now, it turns out we haven't really stopped this thing, we need to vow to each other that we'll come back. And they make this blood pact that they're going to do that. And then now 27 years has passed, and we're in, you know, the present, as it were, because this was set in 1989 or something for the purpose of the movies. So now we're in the present. These kids have grown up. It has come back. And the one kid that stayed behind, Mike Hanlon, starts phoning people up and saying, you got to come back to Derry. We got to take care of this. And that's where the movie kind of, that's where we drop into this story.
Do they reprise the Pennywise actor who really kind of took the character to the next level from its 1970s incarnation?
Yeah, Bill Skarsgård of the Skarsgård acting family again reprises his role and does a really wonderful job with the creepy Pennywise. I think they kind of added to it, but he can kind of do the wall-eyed thing with his eyes, and he does this weird thing with his bottom lip that makes it point. So he's actually doing some of the creepy stuff all on his own in this, and he does a really great job. But if you, dear listener, if you find him frightening at all, just as you hear the voice of Pennywise, think of Winnie the Pooh, because sometimes it sounds very similar. It's a similar sort of like cadence, and then that should maybe make it not as scary.
This is kind of playing upon the notion that, and I draw here from the novels, that everyone has something that they're especially afraid of, and this force that usually manifests itself as Pennywise knows what that is.
Yeah, and basically it discovers this for each person, and then it uses that against them to create more and more fear, which it feeds off of. And then when it's done feeding off of the person, getting as much fear out of them as it can, then it kills them. So the abductions that were happening in the first film turned out to actually to be murders, and those kids are all like dead, And of course, the way this movie starts, you have this suicide of one of the kids now as an adult, right? And the way that, if you remember from the book, they kind of do that at the very beginning. Like Stephen King does that at the beginning of the book. And it does two things. It tells you that even the adults aren't safe from these fears, and like there are consequences to all of this. And also that it introduces you to this character of Eric, the boy. You know that he's going to die before you even meet him as a kid, which is kind of an interesting twist to throw at the beginning of the story. But here they refrain from putting that in the first film, and they put it at the beginning of this film, like within the first 20 minutes of this almost three-hour-long film.
Stephen King is famous for allowing filmmakers to play with his movies, to change things that sometimes irritates Stephen King novel fans like me, because the novels are great. Why change what is really so good? Do they do any of that in It Chapter 2?
Well, they do, and it also kind of becomes a bit of a running joke, because like one thing that Stephen King often does is he writes in surrogates for himself. So James McAvoy plays one of the adult versions of the kids, Bill Denbrough. So he's this surrogate. So he's also a writer, and his books are being turned into movies, and that's how you're introduced to this character. But everybody's constantly telling him, yeah, you're a really good writer, but you can't land the endings. You always screw up your endings. And which is a thing that Stephen King gets from people sometimes too, that he can write these great books, but then he kind of biffs the endings. So that's kind of built right into the story. So you already, it does two things. It's self-referential, but at the same time, it's also telegraphing to you as a viewer that they're going to change some things with the ending of this movie. So get used to the idea. The movie's going to end a little different than the book did. That's what they do with the movie.
Pastor Ted Geese is our guest reviewing the movie It Chapter 2. Well, if you've read the book, you know that part of the book is a bizarre trip into an alternate universe, or maybe a deeper level of our universe, involving a giant cosmic turtle. We'll see if they put that on the film. And we're gonna have a ball just like we always do. Saturday night at the movies.
Who cares what picture you see? What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans in their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
Discover a truly Lutheran approach to education. Concordia University Chicago's Center for the Advancement of Lutheran Liberal Arts supports a vibrant, growing community of classical educators. Whether you're a teacher, administrator, parent, or homeschooler, we have the resources and contacts you need to start a child's journey into the Lutheran Liberal Arts. Visit cuchicago.edu/cala. That's C-A-L-L-A.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc. our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. On this Thursday afternoon, we are reviewing the movie It Chapter 2. Pastor Ted Geese is our guest. Ted, is there a giant cosmic turtle in this film?
There's a small turtle. At one point, there's a turtle on a desk in the school during summer school. That's of a flashback to the kids.
Is that the only reference to to the other dimension that the story deals with in the novel?
Yeah, that's, I mean, that part of it, this kind of cosmic force that is actually quite a lot like Hinduism. Like there's this, in Hinduism, they have this gigantic turtle and the world is sitting on the turtle's back. And Stephen King kind of uses that in the course of this story. And it kind of comes up in some of his other books too. And in the book, that is there kind of supporting and helping the kids and the adults fight Pennywise, because this Pennywise, the evil otherworldly entity with its deadlights, is their antagonists out in the cosmos, as it were. And the giant turtle is there to kind of help them, boost them, support them. So in the first film, they did have like a little turtle made of Lego. They were in a pond swimming, whatever, with each other. And one of them thought they felt a turtle. So they mentioned this turtle occasionally. Like they mention a turtle occasionally, and then there is a spot where you get that in here, but it doesn't go there with that part of it. It does go there in terms of explaining Pennywise as being this otherworldly cosmic force that actually landed on Earth in a meteorite, like way hundreds of years ago in Maine. So like they take that cosmic side of it and they do expand Pennywise's character into that. But they don't also then include this giant turtle.
So they do have this bit of time travel to explain the origins of this evil force in the film?
Well, the one kid that stayed back in town and grew up and kind of is hanging around the library is this Mike Hanlon. And he's been kind of looking into all this stuff over time. Now, in the first film, they had kind of transferred some of this stuff over to Ben Hanscom, because he was the new kid in town and he was like looking at stuff in the library because he didn't have any friends. But here they have Mike Hanlon, like in the book, going back and looking at all this stuff. So he's the one who's kind of dug around and talked to people, found the oral history, whatever, with some Native American people who, Aboriginals who lived near town. All that kind of stuff is imported into the story and kind of told as he's telling it. They have like the flashbacks are part of his telling of what happened in the past. So that's how they introduce this stuff.
So spoiler alert to our listeners, how do they change the ending of this film vis-a-vis the novel?
Todd, do you really want to know?
Yeah, because I'm not going to watch the film. I mean, I just stick to the novels.
Okay. Well, one of the ways in which they change the ending, this kind of fits in with a couple different things that we'll probably want to talk about a little bit more. So I mentioned the character of Stanley Uris, who had committed suicide. So there's a way in which his suicide, which occurs near the beginning of the film, then comes up again at the end of the film. So that's one way in which they've made a change. and we can talk a little bit more about that. The other way is that the character of Richie Toyser, played by Bill Hader in the film as the adult, they've made an adjustment to his character, and it's a twist to that character, which then changes kind of like the way the story ends in the end, right? The other thing is, and we'll talk about that too, but the in the miniseries, like, I don't know if people remember the miniseries. In the miniseries from 1990, they got to the kids get down into the sewers, and the adult versions are down in the sewers, and they have all of this stuff where they actually confront the thing that they're fighting, right? The conclusion of the whole miniseries, and it's this big spider. But the filmmaker, you know, will tell you that he ran out of money. Like, they didn't have enough money to do the spider well. So then it was this kind of cheesy Ray Harryhausen kind of style stop motion animation spider that just didn't come off very well. And it was kind of embarrassing to him as a filmmaker. So here, of course, they spend quite a bit more time with that, and they had a lot more money because the first film was very successful. And they make the spider is part of that, like the spider kind of form of Pennywise is a part of that. But what they do is they continue to use Bill Skarsgård and the Pennywise head, like the big clown head on this spider, as they're fighting it out. So that's a bit of a change too, to the way that it's, because the thing with Stephen King in that book is that it kind of gets into this Lovecraftian kind of, it's so horrible, I can't even describe to you what it looks like. It'll melt your brain if you look at it too hard, kind of stuff, right? So here they've really incorporated out that. The other thing that they made a change in the first film from the book, and then it kind of has a ripple effect in this one, is in the first book, like the kid version of the characters in the book, it's Bev Marsh who uses the slingshot to do in Pennywise initially. And they kind of took that away from her and made her into more of a damsel in distress in that first film. In this film, you know, she also doesn't have as much to do in the midst of everything. So they kind of changed some of that too. So, I mean, these are just some of the changes, and we can get into the stuff about Richie Toyser and Stan Urs as well as we continue to talk.
What do they do with the suicide then?
Well, I think this is a major thing for Christians to really think about, like, or pay attention to, consider, think about afterwards. In the book, it's this act of cowardice. Like, he knows that he made the promise he should go back to Derry. He's got to face Pennywise again, but instead he goes upstairs and he commits suicide, runs the bath and commits suicide. What they do here is that before he does that, he has written them each a letter and sent it to them, and then after everything is resolved, they get the letter and they read the letter. And in the letter, he kind of says, listen, I couldn't face this. I would have been a liability. We wouldn't have succeeded if I'd been there. I had to move myself off of the board so that you would succeed. So what they've done in the film is they've taken this suicide and they've kind of flipped it around and tried to make it into an act of bravery instead of an act of cowardice. And that is not really helpful, I don't think. It certainly goes, like, it's taking, like, something like St. Paul's advice, you know, let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others, like from Philippians chapter 2. It takes advice like that and it twists it around, because committing suicide or killing yourself to, quote unquote, make other people's lives easier is horrible. Like, that is not the point of that. And it almost seems like it's kind of like bait in the movie, and people shouldn't latch on to it, because the world is getting, I don't know if you've noticed, that the world's getting kind of screwy. And there are people, impressionable people, who you'll see like on TV, you'll see like kids crying about the environment, and we should care about the environment. But the idea that, you know, like, if I removed myself because I'm a, you know, I eat food and I use up resources, and me just being around is like wrecking the earth. Like, there are people who might contemplate suicide for a ridiculous reason like that, right? So the idea of taking suicide, making it an act of bravery, is a bad idea. And I think I'm talking to the choir here, but, you know, it's also the kind of idea that is behind, like, eugenics ideas, like abortion. Like, well, you know, this kid is inconvenient. Life would be better if it wasn't there. Or, you know, stuff like euthanasia. It's like, well, they don't have a good quality of life, and they're impacting the lives of the people around them in negative ways. And if they weren't there, then they would make other people's lives easier. So maybe I should just remove myself by suicide. These are awful ideas. And they really, I think, as a Christian watching the film and thinking about it, it goes against things like, you know, from Galatians chapter 6, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Or, you know, if one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together, from 1 Corinthians chapter 12. So essentially, suicide in this respect removes the opportunity to bear one another's burdens, and also removes the possibility of rejoicing together when suffering is past, because they do defeat Pennywise, but Stanley Urs isn't there to actually enjoy that with them. And that's, to me, that's kind of a sad part. And Stephen King got it right. But here, you know, the change that they've made to try to keep him involved in the story, the character, and to make it so that he didn't, like, break his promise, actually is a really bad addition to this, and kind of a dangerous one.
Pastor Ted Geese is our guest reviewing the movie It Chapter 2. There's a little tinkering with another character. We'll find out what it is after this.
Jesus tells in the parable of the sower how the seed of the word is assaulted by birds and weeds and sun.
Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, A Martyr's Faith in a Faithless World.
This is the assault on our faith which the Lord wants to fight against and prevent. Some seed, that is, enduring faith, endures to the end, and the Lord teaches us how to have it in His Word.
Learn more about A Martyr's Faith in a Faithless World at issuesetc.org.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Gospel reductionism replaces the Bible as the source and norm of theology with the gospel. What would a gospel reductionist edition of Luther's Small Catechism look like? Find out in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Russell Dawn details his journey from Anglicanism to Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're reviewing the movie It Chapter 2. Pastor Ted Geese is our guest. He taught a course for Concordia Lutheran Seminary titled Christianity in the Movies, A Lutheran Approach to Media Consumption. This is what Pastor Brian Wolfmiller has to say in his latest book called A Martyr's Faith in a Faithless World. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September. There is a difference in the life of an unbeliever and a Christian. Paul notes that we once walked according to the desires of the flesh. We fed our appetites. We were driven by our passions, but no longer. These things are put away, put to death. We wear the new self, which is constantly being renewed in knowledge and the image of our Creator. This putting on Christ is what happens in our baptism and continues in our life of repentance. Good, solid, biblical teaching in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, A Martyr's Faith in a Faithless World. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and order A Martyr's Faith, 1-800-325-3040. Pastor Geese, you mentioned the other character, Richie Tozer. How does the film tinker with his character?
Well, okay, so what they do is, along the way, you get some of these little things that like Pennywise will say to him, you know, I know what your secret is, or whatever, to him. And in the end, what it turns out to be, that they really strongly intimate this, is about as strongly as possible, is that when they were teenage kids or young adolescent kids, he had a crush on Eddie Kasprek, another one of the kids. So that there's this gay crush. So at the very end of the movie, then, like, the character of Eddie Kasprek dies fighting Pennywise. So this kid that he had had a crush on, who now is an adult, died fighting Pennywise, and he's left behind afterwards. And coming to terms with all of this, he ends up going to the covered bridge, and he carves his initial and Eddie's initial into the wood of the bridge. And this is intended to give you the, like, strong intimation that, yes, his secret was that he was, in fact, a gay guy. And while I understand a little bit of why they may have done that in terms of the story, this is certainly something that they've added that isn't in the book. And actually, it's something that they've added that they didn't even hint at in the movie from 2017. So this is an extra, this is a retconning, an extra additional addition. And because of the nature of the way they split this, the book, into two parts, one of the things that happens at the very beginning of the book is that, and again, we talked about how Derry is kind of a terrible town, is that there's this incident in which a gay couple is bullied and killed, like assaulted, and one of them is killed as a result. And Stephen King included that because there was an actual crime that occurred like that while he was writing the book. And he wanted to show just how terrible this town was. And it's also a visceral, real-world thing. It doesn't involve, like, anything terribly supernatural. It doesn't have to. It's bad enough by itself. So that is, of course, because they've split this book into two movies the way they did. They didn't include any of that necessarily in the first film, but they did include this assault where this guy dies at the beginning of this film. So Chapter 2, it's at the beginning of this film. So they've included this at the beginning of this film, and I think maybe the writer may have felt like, well, and this is hard because you can't, like, it's hard to, like, get into the head of the writer, but it's like, you've got this, you know, hate crime, this violent attack based on the fact that these guys are like a gay couple. Well, to balance that out, you need to have something else, some sort of redeeming quality and all of that. So it seems like maybe that's why they chose to do this with this character, but it does still feel shoehorned in. And like this happens over and over again when they make remakes and reimaginings and reboots, and they go and change things like this, or even just like where they take things like when we watched, we talked about Ghostbusters, the one that had the all-female cast, where they're doing this kind of stuff on purpose, maybe to appeal to a particular segment of the population. But it, at the same time, what it does is it can be off-putting to fans of the original material.
People who are fans of King's books will also note that Derry comes up again and again and again and again and again.
Yes.
Yeah. He has about three towns, fictional towns that he has created.
They Castle become, Rock and, yeah.
They become characters in the novels, and they are revisited and visited, and there's so much overlap between the various novels. There's cross-referencing. There's, you know, for those who are looking for those Easter eggs in his novels, it's kind of a fascinating thing to see. Mm-hmm. One of the things I liked about the first It remake there was that they really did capture what I see in my mind when I see Derry, Maine. They did. And I know that it's based upon one of the places where Stephen King has a home in a very vague way. Did they do it again in all the locales that are so now iconic to Stephen King fans?
Not as well as they did in the first film. Because I think in the first film you had, like, when Georgie gets, you know, attacked by Pennywise, you know, by the storm drain, and gets dragged in underneath into the sewers, there's a lady, like in the house right over there who sees that happen, and she just goes back inside. Like the idea that, you know, like just how terrible it's become, like for all of the people there, they did a better job of that in the first film. In this film, there's not as much interaction between the characters and people in town. I kind of wish that they had a little more of that to like do what you're talking about and really paint the town the way that you find in the book. And again, like this is almost a 3-hour long movie, so you'd think that they would have time to do that. But somehow it doesn't quite do that. And this is where this film is not as good as the previous film. So it kind of leans heavy on the previous film and is just not as smooth and not as, it's a little shallow. It doesn't dive deep into, you know, the gray water as it were of Derry. And then actually, you know, another thing about how they changed the ending, since we're spoiling things, is the ending of the book, the whole town is like destroyed at the end of the book. And in this, it's just the house on Niebold Street caves in. And again, that's budget, right? Like it's very expensive to have the entire town flooded and destroyed. It's cheaper to have one house collapse in on itself. So Derry kind of survives the end of it. And in the book, it doesn't really survive in that kind of way.
Talk a little bit about maybe a connection that Christian viewers can make, because the whole theme that runs through both of these films, whether they're children or adults, is that they're all members of this little losers club, as they call it, a bullied group of kids that are outcast for all of their own very, I'll say, iconic reasons. Stephen King just pulls these kids right off the shelf in a lot of ways from any grade school in America. What connections might be made there?
Well, I think this might be one of the more positive points you could take out of this, is this idea that, like, they end the film and they really make a point of saying, you know, that they're still losers. You know, even though they won, they're still losers. And I think in terms of the Christian, you know, the world will look at Christians as losers. They just don't get it. They don't understand what's going on. So like what you have in the book where you've got like, and in the film, where these guys have actually, basically these guys have saved the town. But nobody knows that they did. So the town still looks, would still look at them as though they're losers. There's no parade for them. They're not being put on plaques, or there's no statues and stuff. They just go back to their lives. And for Christians, we know that the victory is won in Christ at his cross and his passion, his death and resurrection, and that the devil, sin, death, the world, even ourselves has been beat by Christ. But people are like, we live in a world where there are people who are unaware of this or ignorant of it and don't know. So they would look at us still as losers, even though we've already won. So I think this is kind of an interesting part of it, that if you're going to draw something positive out of the movie, maybe it's that kind of element of it. And again, you know, like they do kind of dive into this idea at the end, particularly of how you look at your past makes a difference about how you live your future. Now for them, there's, you know, some of this kind of self-forgiveness and way of addressing, like accepting your past kind of a thing. For Christians, we would look at it and say, well, if you are repentant and you have asked for forgiveness and God has forgiven you and he has promised to forget your sins, then they are forgotten. And, you know, if the devil throws those back at you again, or if you keep remembering those things, you can turn and say, no, I'm not going to take the bait. I know that that stuff is behind me and it's been forgiven and it's done. So, you know, like the idea of moving on from your childhood fears and traumas and forging forward is something that Christians would embrace too. But of course, it isn't self-forgiveness and self-acceptance as much as finding your identity in Christ. That would be a difference between the Christian look at that and what you find in the book or the film.
One other thing that I think people may be concerned about, the theme of at least the childhood phase of this, the story of It, has these kids pretty much on their own. Adults in this world, or at least in that town, probably cause more trouble for these kids than they help. Parents are very ineffectual in this.
Mm-hmm. or malicious.
Yeah. So yeah. Does the adult version in the second film kind of redeem adults in the universe of this film where kids are not entirely on their own?
Well, one of the problems, like for Bill Denbrough, who is played by James McAvoy in this film, he has a lot of angst and issues because his little brother Georgie was the one that was taken by Pennywise, you know, and so he feels guilt about that. So you do have this little character of a kid with a skateboard who is actually from the book, and they reprise that in the film here. And he discovers that this kid is actually living in his old house, and so he takes out of his own time and concern interest in this kid and tries to protect the kid. So he tells the kid, don't talk to anybody if you hear anything coming out of that drain, like the storm drain. Don't engage in a conversation. He wants to help try to save that kid. So in that way, you've got an adult who actually cares about trying to help a kid out who's perhaps in danger. He fails in the course of the movie in one of the more creepy moments in the film, but he is actually trying to help. And the idea then is that, like, they had ostensibly, when they left Derry, Maine, they kind of forgot about everything. There was like almost like a glamour on their mind. They couldn't remember anything anymore. There was like, they just couldn't remember their past. So when they return to town, they start remembering everything. Sometimes it's easier to just forget or just to look the other way. And these are adults that actually don't forget and don't look the other way. When they have something brought to their attention, they do actually think about it and they confront it. And I guess in that way, you could say that the adult characters are redeemed in this film compared to the adult characters you had in the previous film who were supposed to be looking after these kids but doing a lousy job.
You point out that this second of the films begins with Derry's summer carnival, and you say it kind of could be viewed as a picture of the film itself. What do you mean?
Well, I don't know about you, but I've been to some of those kind of summer carnivals. We had one called Farmer's Days in Stony Plain, Alberta, where I grew up. Or, you know, like there's big ones, like we have the Queen City X here in Regina. But, you know, they're traveling shows. They got the Midway, they got clowns, they got the whole shebang, right? Fun houses, and then they've got like the little rides and stuff that they take apart and move and put up again. And they're all kind of, you know, you're thinking to yourself, are all of these bolts and screws tightened nice or not, right? So there is a sense that this movie is kind of like one of those traveling carnivals, that it's fun at the time. It's like for people who like the spills and chills and, you know, bumps and scares, it's fun at the moment, but probably in the long run, people will probably revisit the first film because it's really drawing on stuff like Stand By Me and Stranger Things and stuff like that and doing a good job. This is probably the part of this two-part presentation of the book that people will skip. They're not going to come to this one, I don't think, as much as that first one. So in a way, you know, this is going to be the one where the popcorn goes stale, the red balloons lose their helium, the you know, cotton candy's gone. That's kind of what this is going to be like. You're like, in the end, it was fun while it was happening, but that's about as far as it's going to get, I think.
We recently had Pet Sematary. There have been multiple remakes of The Shining. Now It, they're done with that one. Do you know of any other King novels that are coming back to theaters in film remakes?
Well, there's a flood of stuff going on. I guess season 2 of the TV show Castle Rock, which is kind of a riff on Stephen King stuff, is coming out. Is it this month or next month? Anyways, October or November of 2019. But the big one probably that people are looking forward to will be Dr. Sleep, which is based on Stephen King's novel, Dr. Sleep, which is the sequel to The Shining. So with Ewan McGregor playing little Danny Torrance, now grown up. So that's the one coming out later this year that people are going to be interested in and which I bet we'll be talking about.
So get ready for creepy senior citizens in motorhomes coming to a film theater near you.
That's right. Well, this, and in terms of creepy, like this, chapter two, it has its moments. One of the guys that I saw it with, he said, the hair on my back stood on end. And then he said, I have a lot of hair on my back. So there are definitely some moments that are going to give people the jumps. That's for sure.
Pastor Ted Geese has a bachelor's degree in fine arts. He's pastor of Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. He taught a course for Concordia Lutheran Seminary titled Christianity in the Movies, A Lutheran Approach to Media Consumption. You can read his review of It Chapter 2 at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Ted, thanks.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., it's This Week in Pop Christianity. We'll have Chris Rosebro answer the question, does the Bible teach that Christians can time travel? Strange question, maybe an interesting answer. We'll discuss a new study disproving a gay gene with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris, and we'll play Issues Etc., Soundbite of the Week. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.